At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Check it out now. No doubt now.
It's May 25th, 2023, the Beating the Book podcast, man. French Open Edition. Skill Alexander. For the tennis hardos, as Drew likes to say, which I love. That's the greatest comment ever. It doesn't get any better than tennis for me because there's only two people on earth I'd like to do these shows with, and they are kind enough to amuse me and join me for however long it takes to talk about these slams. And I think we do Indian Wells as well. We sort of stretch it to a fifth. But it's Drew Dinsick from both the Bet the Edge, NBC Sports Bet the Edge, and Deep Dive podcast at Whale _ Capper, of course, our buddy Drew. And then a gentleman who I was lucky enough to finally meet after all these years. He came to Vegas. We hung out. I wish we could have hung out more, but he had other stuff he was doing as well. At Tennis Ratings on Twitter. You've seen his work at Betfair, at Pinnacle. It's our buddy Dan Weston. Dan, how are you, first of all? You good?
Oh, fantastic, Gil. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, looking forward to doing this pod.
Absolutely. And Drew, you good as well?
Oh, yeah, this is the best time of year. The French Open is a unique slam. I mean, they're all unique. They all have specific characteristics and qualities. But this one is fun because we have a lot. We have a lot of data to work with. Usually, you know, you're handicapping tennis and you're dealing with small sample size issues left and right. But we've had a full 2 months of, you know, clay court tennis to pick through the data and find some edges. So this is a really fun one to handicap.
How has your run-up, let's start there, how has your run-up to the French Open gone? I had a nice dog winner this morning on Julia Riera, but to be honest with you, it's been very choppy for me on this run-up. How about for you?
I'm in that boat for sure. I feel like I've had second place in every big one. So, you know, it's that's kind of the name of the game. Some good reads, some just couldn't get across the finish line here. I'm trying to think if I've had any big winners. I guess no, not really. Like the last big plus money on my log is Carlos Alcaraz at Indian Wells. So it's been a while since I hit a big number.
Boy, Indian Wells. Yeah. I attended Indian Wells. It feels like it was 6 months ago. Like it really
does. Yeah,
it feels right. Dano, you've been involved in cricket as well as tennis. So have you been betting a lot of tennis before this?
Yeah, no. So basically, yeah, just sort of match to match stuff. Just generally, would be more of my focus rather than outrights right now. The Masters stuff has actually been pretty okay. My Betfair column is certainly well into profit over the last few Masters, so that's been positive. First of all, from a day to day perspective, rather than looking outright so much. But yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Look, can't wait for this tournament as well. This is going to be, I think, both the men's and the women's, I think, have got really unique dynamics that I'm really looking forward to discussing. And this is the tournament on a whole.
So let's get into it, because last year, so Dan, you weren't with us for the French Open pod last year, I don't think. Drew and I were doing it while the draw was coming out. And it's always sort of tricky figuring out when the draw happens. So this morning, it was about 4 hours ago. We're doing this just after 9 a.m. Pacific time on the East Coast. Was it after 5 p.m., I guess, where you are, Dano, in England? And so it's, we just got it out. Drew was kind enough to text me while it was happening. So let's just start with the macro. Let's start with the men's side, where prior to the draw, Carlos Alcaraz, Novak Djokovic, the short shots in that order to win the men's side of the French Open. Then the draw came out. Drew, and let's just give sort of the macro sort of viewpoint, the helicopter view of the men's draw, where since the draw has come out, Alcaraz and Djokovic still are the short shots, but not quite as short as they once were.
Yeah, I guess the big story coming into this tournament was the flip-flop of the 2 and 3 seeds. You know, Dan and I talked some tennis less than a week ago, and at that time, it looked pretty likely that Djokovic was going to be on the bottom half of the draw, Alcaraz at the top, and the only way they could ever meet would be if that was your final. So those guys being at the top of the market, and you could argue experience versus form all live long day about who of those two should have been the, you know, the favorite. I would have told you Djokovic probably should have been a little bit closer to Alcaraz. Other people would tell you that Djokovic's injury concerns are bothering them, blah, blah, blah. Well, that all kind of goes out the window because Medvedev wins Rome. That flipped him into the 2 seed. And then Djokovic was a free draw to land on the top or the bottom. And they drew him into the top. And so he's now the top seed in the second quarter, which means if he hits head to head with Alcaraz, it's going to be in the semifinals, not the finals. And if you are a regular listener of this podcast, or you break down tournaments in general, you know that that means that there's an imbalance in the draw overall. And when there's an imbalance in the draw overall, that opens up the door for shooting your shot on outright prices in the bottom half of the draw. And the reason of that behind that is very, very mathematically clean. There is anyone in the bottom only has to beat one of the top two. Mathematically impossible to have to go through Djokovic and Alcaraz if you are Medvedev, if you are Sinner, if you are Rune, if you are Rude. And so for those reasons, I think, you know, realistically, you have to start your handicap looking at those four players, evaluating their form, evaluating their performances at Roland Garros and on the clay run-up, and figure out which of those four you want to stake your cart to. And then, you know, let Alcaraz and Djokovic go to war on the top, and then, you know, figure out a way to, you know, maximize your position once you get to the final.
Yeah, as we've said many times, when we've had imbalances like this, we always relate it to an American sport. And so LeBron with the Cleveland Cavaliers is sort of the easy way to sort of, you know, have an analog to that.
Great analog.
Right, where the Western Conference was deep. And then LeBron could sort of get his team, no matter who he was playing with, to the NBA Finals, and then come what may, come the NBA Finals, but he'd only have to beat one of those teams. So what Drew is referring to is Alcaraz ends up in Q1. Nori is in there as well, Tsitsipas, Shevchenko, for those who have a bit more of a deep dive on some of these players. Djokovic is in Q2 with Rublev. Stan Wawrinka fans will say he's in there as well. Q3, Rune and Rude, to your point. Cerundolo is also in there. And Sinner and Medvedev in Q4. So exactly what Drew's talking about, that Q3, Q4, how you think of Rune, Rude, Sinner, and Medvedev might really trigger a bet. Dan, is that generally how you are approaching this?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's really important to note that with Rune and Medvedev in the same half of the draw, It's such an interesting dynamic, because over the last couple of weeks, I think I mentioned this as well when I caught up with Drew last week on a different pod, was that this, and I've been writing about this a lot, Medvedev was consistently 2.5 times the outright price of Tsitsipas and Rune over the sort of second half of Rome.
Drew, we talked about that 2 days ago. Yeah, crazy. 2 days ago.
Yeah, you look at the match prices against Tsitsipas and Rune in Rome, and it was like barely any difference. It was like a very shade of odds against for Medvedev, and now he's won the tournament. The market has clearly reacted, but I think the value on Medvedev was certainly in that period in Rome where he looked like he was starting to get a little bit more comfortable on anything that wasn't fast. Sorry, anything that wasn't super slow clay. I think a super slow clay, if this was Monte Carlo, for example, I think that still he should double his price right now. But currently, I think that there's been that market correction. And certainly Tsitsipas, as my old favorite phrase is friendless in the market right now.
Friendless in the market. That's right. It's the greatest Dano phrase ever. So Medvedev, let me just attach some numbers to this. So to win it all, Medvedev, which Drew, I think you and I were talking about, were 15-1, was 15-1 2 days ago. He's plus 950 now.
I think he was 25-1.
Was he?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Wow.
There were some stale prices when we were talking about this Tuesday. He was 25-1 or something. We'll have to go check the tape. Maybe it was 18-1, but whatever the case was, it was stale.
Rune is plus 950. Medvedev is plus 950. Sinner remains. Well, not remains, but he's down to 13-1. Rude, 25-1. So he goes down.
Oh, I have the prices from last Friday when I wrote the my Pinnacle preview, which was last Friday. Medvedev was 25.57 on Pinnacle.
Yeah. Ridiculous. Man. Now he's your favorite to come out of the bottom. I mean, I think just based on basically any public ELO you want to look at, he's your favorite to come out of the bottom.
And you were saying before the show, Drew, that we don't necessarily get into head to heads that much, but this is a noteworthy one, perhaps to some degree.
Well, yeah, I think at for me at least, what matters in terms of kind of clay performance is just your ability to win points on return, your ability to convert those return points to breaks, because the clay game is a lot more about kind of navigating, break and hold, as opposed to grass or Australian Open type of hard court speed, where it's a lot more just can you hold on for dear life against a good serve. And so it's a very different type of game on clay. And you looked at across the entire breadth of men's players on clay this season, and Sinner stands out as having some pretty outstanding numbers. He's gone up against some meaningful competition. He's played enough matches that you're not really concerned about small sample size here. And, for those reasons, he kind of popped as, well, maybe he should be the third choice, even though, he's been dealing with injuries lately and, hasn't made deep runs that you can really point to really recently. Seeing him initially get drawn in with Medvedev was like, oh, cool. Like, this is great. Medvedev, this is now maybe a sell point on Medvedev because he's shortened so aggressively. Sinner is ready to make his first run to a slam final. And I'm thinking in my head, how would I price that match? Let's look at their numbers. Okay, I would make Sinner a small favorite on a clay neutral, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, how have they done past performance? And Medvedev has this guy in the bag. I am kind of shocked. I didn't already kind of know this off the top of my head, but Medvedev has faced Sinner now 6 times and beaten him all 6. Now, granted, it's a skewed sample or a biased sample because a lot of those are indoor hardcourt, faster services than we're going to have in Roland Garros. I definitely don't love getting in bed with a player who's got to kind of kill the boogeyman in a slam setting. that's kind of asking a lot. And I think, again, now that we've seen the market react so aggressively in favor of Medvedev, you have to expect that you're probably going to get Sinner at a dog price in that match. And so maybe it makes more sense just to find a way to attack that match as opposed to getting super aggressive in the outright markets with Sinner. Sinner, he's been the better player in a lot of matches that I've seen at the slam level, and he's lost. And so there may be something mentally he still has to hurdle, and the fact that he has to go through Medvedev to do it is a little concerning. And the best analog I can give to you about this, and a guy that still has not killed the boogeyman, is Rublev. Rublev, if he ever runs into Medvedev in a slam setting, forget about it. Like 3-0, like write it in pen. I don't believe him being able to get over that hurdle unless the conditions are perfect. Realistically, it's maybe shaping up that way for Sinner, but that I think is pretty clearly, in my opinion, that's your Q4 quarterfinal. And if I had to guess, the winner of that match is probably your bottom half finalist.
Medvedev or Sinner.
Yeah.
I probably should have started this. I should have started this, by the way. I'm just not on my P's and Q's by saying Rafa Nadal is not in this tournament, for those who are unaware.
Who?
22 slams, 14 of which is just a cartoon number, right? 14 of which are here at Roland Garros, the King of Clay, thusly called. And he's not here because of injury. And I'm curious, Danny, because this has nothing to do with anything. But if he were, let's say he didn't call that press conference, and then once he called it, we knew he wasn't going to play. But let's say he was playing in this. This would be so confusing too many as a handicap, right? Because you'd have this looming specter. Yes, he's hurt, yes, but he's still Rafa, and it's still Roland Garros. Like, do you think it would have messed with you a little bit?
100%. Yeah, and it would have messed with the market as well. The pricing, I think, would have been a much more volatile in terms of potential movement on a day-to-day basis, because we've got those kind of intangibles with Nadal's injuries. But then the fact that everyone's going to have to give him respect because it is Nadal. It is Roland Garros. He has that record here.
Yeah. 102-3, by the way, match record.
Jesus.
Is that good?
But I think we also would have had to rationalize the fact that, you know, this is seven matches of best of five on the toughest surface on your body. And this is the surface where, on average, the points are longer, the sets are longer, the matches are longer. A five-setter is brutal. I remember back in the day, Andy Murray had a I think it was a quarterfinal against Gael Monfils, and he was two sets up, and Monfils took it to a fifth, and Murray won the match, placed Nadal in the semifinal, and I was like, yeah, he's done. He's got no chance. Coming off like 4 hours against Monfils, he's got no chance against Nadal next round. He's done. And that's what can happen to you on clay. So for me, yes, we're talking about Nadal, but it also brings up a really nice broader point as well, in terms of, and it's something I've talked about a lot, is getting through that first week without expending too much effort.
Yes.
And that's actually something that I'm a little bit concerned about with Djokovic, because he's only won 60% of sets on clay this season so far. And he's dropped sets against mediocre players. He's taken to tiebreaks by guys like Ivan Gakov. And this is not the Djokovic of old. And so for me, we don't really know how his elbow is, how it's going to stand up to seven matches, best of five sets in long matches. So, yeah, that's me in terms of the market leaders in the men's tournament right now.
Two things. Murray not playing either in this French Open, and I sold Nadal short. If I'm being accurate, it's 112-3. Just want to point that out. So my mistake. You drew, so that's interesting what Dan is saying about, and the concern, and this is a huge concern, because we'll get to the women's side, but that's been such a great thing for Iga too. Like, she just coasted through early matches, which allowed her to be fresh later in her two French Open title runs. Mm-hmm. You don't believe wholeheartedly, I don't want to mischaracterize it, in Alcaraz yet as a best of five guy. Like, you're not completely bought into that, right?
Well, it's not necessarily as simple as I don't think he can be that guy. It's just more we haven't seen him do it at a level where you can have enough confidence to make him this short of a price.
Okay.
A lot of people in the tennis community and the way that the market is reacting right now, I think there's a sentiment out there that there is a little bit of a passing of the torch right now. Nadal is the greatest clay player we will have ever seen when it's all said and done. There's no way Alcaraz could catch him, I don't think. But at the same time, like, the torch seems to have been passed with the way that Alcaraz has played on clay last swing and this swing. So it's, you know, people maybe expect him to kind of take the throne this year, but Djokovic is very clearly in the way. It's the match that they had last year in Madrid was probably the best clay match we had all season, I think. Just off the top of my head, that was my favorite match, at least. Alcaraz got the better of him, but it was best of three. And you now add an additional layer of, you need to continue to find that level for, you know, one more set. And we've seen other really good young players run into trouble with that, notably Tsitsipas in the, French Open final 2 years ago. If that was a best of three match, he's a slam champion and his entire career arc may look different, but he bottled it. And, you know, a ton of that credit you have to give to Djokovic in the way he knows how to navigate a best of five match. And, the injury concerns are real. Dropping sets are a problem, surely. But I've had too many instances in life where I've doubted Djokovic based on health, and then it hasn't mattered at all at the time level.
We all have.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
he tends to always be kind of peaking when we get to the Slam. So, you know, we'll see if anything different this year. Obviously, an elbow injury is a little bit more concerning in tennis than whatever he was dealing with in Australia. I think it was like hamstring or quad or something. But, you know, elbow is a little spookier. But that said, you know, I think he's still probably the player to beat for the foreseeable future. Because he's just got so much more experience that, you know, when the going gets tough, he knows what to do. And these other guys have to figure that out still. And it's one thing to figure it out against, you know, Alcaraz had some weird opening matches, I believe, last year in Roland Garros. I'll pull him up while I'm kind of vamping here. But, you know, he solved some questions and answered, you know, figured out some problems in the best of five level last season, especially, you know, particularly on his way to winning his first Slam in US Open. But he really didn't face anyone of quality until, you know, he got ousted
quarters. Zverev beat him in the quarters.
It was quarters. Yeah, Zverev got him in the quarters. And if you rewatch that match, that was kind of a shocker, honestly. Like, yeah, Zverev was playing very well at that time.
The match before Zverev got hurt against Nadal.
Yeah, that was the match before Zverev got hurt. But realistically, like, that was kind of a warning sign that Alcaraz still has a long way to go to get to best of five Slam. You know, kind of head going toe to toe with a guy like Djokovic, in my opinion. What was it early in that match? He almost got ousted by Albert Ramos in the second round of that one. Just a shocking tiebreak loss in set two, followed by with a 5-7 defeat in set three. So he was on the ropes and had to kind of dig deep to get by Ramos, which is a little bit, you know, concerning. And, similar, you know, there's enough similar kind of red flags in his best of five resume that until he kind of emphatically shows that he's the same sort of mental makeup of the likes of the Nadals and the Djokovic's of the world, I can't put him in under plus 200 type of price range for any kind of Slam, regardless of the field.
Do you feel similarly, Dan, or are you a little more bullish on Alcaraz?
Yeah, I'm probably a little bit more bullish, actually. And I think probably ultimately, Minja caught up, I think, last week it was. And this is probably our biggest area of contention. I think we were pretty much 99% agreed on everything else. But for me, I look at the numbers and I look at how Djokovic has played on clay this year, and I just can't have Djokovic any shorter. So given the fact that the duo really are so far ahead of the rest of them, it's difficult really to dispute the Alcaraz price, I think.
So then just short...
Obviously, yes, yeah.
Go ahead, Dan, I'm sorry. Thought we dropped sorry, out. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no worries. Yes, so yes, he lost to Zverev last year here. Very different Zverev to the one that's taking to the courts now, for sure. I think Zverev is like top 20 type level now rather than a top five level. But then he also got through two five-setters at US Open as well. So that's a positive. I remember a few years back, we would all have had the same conversations about Medvedev, and now no one really is too concerned about that from that perspective. So yeah, look, the reason why I like Alcaraz as well is because of the return data side of things. Him and Djokovic and Sinner, I think, really are the best returners in the field, and that gives them the, assuming Djokovic is anywhere near fit and playing at a good level, which is, I think, far from a given right now. Because there's such a massive advantage in terms of getting matches done quickly. And certainly, I think that Alcaraz is going to dominate early rounds and just get it done, like, and maybe drop 8-9 games in three sets or something like that. And we'll go into the week two, I think, pretty fresh. I think that's a key thing. And certainly, I mean, that's my one issue with Djokovic right now. Numbers-wise, this year he's running at like 105% service return points won combined, which is, you know, sort of top 6-7 level, probably you would say, rather than than top two level, and certainly is the long term reason as to why no one really thinks that Tsitsipas has got much of a chance in Grand Slams, because that variance-heavy approach in terms of being serve-oriented is too much for him to overcome in seven matches best of five. And, you know, you look at his draw, and I think he this is not nearly the Isner of old, but, you know, like an Isner-Tsitsipas, that match is a variance nightmare, potentially, you know, if Isner at least can serve as well as
Isner well. Matches tend to be, right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you've got two of them against each other, that can be a bit of a leveler. I obviously Tsitsipas is going to be a massive favorite for that, but ultimately that's going to be a match that swings on a few break points, maybe tie breaks, stuff like that. And exposing yourself to that early in a tournament is not a good thing.
It's a great point.
Couple of kind of closing thoughts on experience here.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
There's only one player in this field who has really proven it, and that's Djokovic. And it's to the degree that it is tough to ever hold anyone against him. He's 425 at this point in his career, best of five matches, winning percentages like almost 90% in best of five tennis. And Alcaraz, this is going to be his 32nd best of five match in round one. So he has a long, long, long way to go to really kind of rack up what I think of as a pretty important aspect of best of five tennis, which is just, it's like chess, you know. And if you watched any of Djokovic Nadal last year at Roland Garros, the previous year at Roland Garros, like, it wasn't even just who was the better player that day. It was literally who moved their pieces at the right time, in the right place, in the right, you know, and reserved their energy for the right moments in that set, because the margin between the players was so narrow. And until Alcaraz kind of goes through the, you know, pays his tuition, so to speak, and, you know, at the best of five level, I just don't know that I could put him in the same conversation. And, you know, to your point about Medvedev not, you know, thinking he didn't have the goods, I will hold my hand up that I was like, this guy is the next generation of the lost generation. Like, I was certainly in that camp until at the US Open, he made it to the final against Rafa Nadal. And I remember looking at that price and being like, 3-0, not, you know, like, this guy's a chump. He's going to get blown off the court. He put Rafa Nadal to a five setter that day. And it was like, whoa, like, this guy's got the intestinal fortitude I didn't know he had. And in that particular match, some of his specific strategy that he put on display against Nadal was like, this guy's Djokovic light. Like, holy smokes. Like, he's got all the same tools. Like, and so, you know, we may come out of this particular slam where Alcaraz lifts up the cup at the end, and he, on the way, he has proven he can outfox a fit Djokovic in a semifinal match. And at that point, I think you have to just tip your hat and say, okay, well, for every US Open and Roland Garros in the foreseeable future, Alcaraz should be shorter than 2-1. Like, that could entirely be the reality we live with from July on. But I kind of, I'm willing to pay to see it, considering the price they're asking you right now to bet Alcaraz.
The nice thing about this conversation, and I'm glad we found something that you guys disagree on, is this is a moment in time, right? Like, we won't be able to have this 2 years from now, where it's like the crossing of Alcaraz on the way up and Djokovic inevitably with an age curve will fall off. Just question is how soon. Djokovic going for a record 23rd Grand Slam singles title. So because I want to get to the women's side, let's get some brass tacks here. So Alcaraz and Djokovic, if they're to meet, are going to meet in the semifinals, which leaves the bottom half open. Would you recommend a bet on Medvedev at this current price, or is it too short for you now?
I mean, I think you missed the boat. If you didn't listen to our Pinnacle podcast last week, if you didn't listen to the numbers game this week, I think you got to sit it out at this point. Especially because you don't have any wiggle room now. Like, right. Let me just see what my numbers. My numbers would make Medvedev a meaningful dog against Alcaraz and a significant dog against Djokovic on clay.
All right, let me try it this way. If I came to you from the future, we'll start with you, Dano. And I said, hey, guess what, guys? Alcaraz didn't win this. Djokovic didn't win this. And neither Medvedev or Sinner won this. I'll make it more difficult by putting Sinner in there. Who did?
That's you might as well get a pin and stick it in the 123 players left in the draw. I think
your knee-jerk reaction wouldn't be Holger Rune or Casper Ruud right off the top?
I think it has to be Holger Rune, I think, ultimately in that situation. Although I personally wouldn't go down that road from an outright perspective with knowledge that we, those four players are still live contenders, obviously. Ruud is a worry for me in terms of his recent level, but also playing this week is never really a great idea ahead of a slam. There's a good reason why the best players never play the week before a slam.
That's right.
And he's obviously not taken that advice. And so for me, that's an issue.
Meaning he needs to work on the game a little more still.
This, like I said earlier, this is seven matches, best of five sets on the hardest surface on your body. So why would you want to go and play four matches?
I agree.
On the same surface the week before? That's just nuts.
I would take it a step further and tell you that he is telling us that he needs those points because he doesn't think he can defend his final points here.
That's a really good point. Yeah, such a good point.
Mm. No love for Cam Nori, Drew? Do I even need to ask you?
not in that part of the draw.
Okay.
No, thank you. Thank you. Now, see, this is funny because if he does something crazy here and like make it to the second week, it's going to sound stupid that we're laughing about this. But, he's got the opposite part of the equation where best of five really plays into his strength, which is he's a marathon man. And, he's going to be able to outlast a player who's more talented than him at some point in this, in this particular tournament. It may be Musetti in round three, but at that point, I cannot see him winning a set off Alcaraz. He just doesn't have anywhere close to the quality. So Nori's road at best ends in the fourth round, as far as I can tell you. Felix, I don't know what's going on with him. I think you pretty much just draw a line through him. Same issue. He's playing this week and not playing with confidence. And then, the rest of the kind of next tier of guys agree. You got to basically scratch Ruud, even though I had hoped he would end up in this type of situation where he is, has the highest ceiling of anyone, I think, in his quarter. But, he's just not playing with confidence right now. His 2023 campaign has been pretty miserable. Rune has some of the issues that I worry about with, or that Dan kind of brought up about Djokovic. He's been playing too much tennis. And not just too many matches, but like matches where there's no reason he should have to go to a third set to beat some of these players he's up against. He's making a mess of stuff. Inexperience is probably the reason. He could find himself at the short end of like just a difficult physical ask considering how much he's played. I don't see anyone I'm like especially scared of in the third quarter. Kecmanovic has played well, but not well enough.
I was going to say, is there a player, and you don't have to answer this if there is no answer to it, but is there a player in any one of these quarters? Obviously, Q1 down, Alcaraz in one, Djokovic in two, Rune and Ruud in three, Sinner and Medvedev in four. Is there any player in any of those quarters where you're like, if something broke this way, that might be interesting?
Yeah, the guy that stands out for me if something breaks this way is Rublev. Because of where he is, like if Djokovic either has an elbow injury and is a walkover, or if he hits a ball woman and then throw it or whatever, then you know, then Rublev all of a sudden is very much your favorite to come out of Q2. Q2 otherwise is pretty weak, I gotta tell you.
Yeah, it is.
And that's kind of one of the reasons why I don't mind being bullish Djokovic, just because I think he can kind of play with his food and still be your semifinalist. But, you know, I think Rublev has shown you enough positives this year, getting over the hump, getting a Masters title, especially right at the beginning of the cycle, so that that wasn't like kind of dwelling in the back of his head, and he was able to work on other aspects of this game in preparation for this. You know, he's going to be a tough out if he can get, you know, some sort of variance, positive variance, and get by Djokovic. He is a game that matches up, I think, pretty well for Alcaraz. So that would be a really fun head-to-head in the semifinal. And, you know, again, assuming he doesn't have to play the boogeyman in the finals, you know, he would be live against pretty much everyone on the bottom half of the draw, as far as I can tell you.
Anything for you, Dan?
Yeah, so for me, if I'm looking at a sort of upsets and players who get through the draw, because I think a lot of players are okay with beating each other, by looking at and ways that someone like a Djokovic might not get to the latter stages somehow, I'm looking at an opponent who has a really high ceiling, someone who's volatile, someone
who... Hey, Dan, hold on one second. Because
draw him and just scrap.
Your audio is breaking up. Start again, and let's hear the part. Someone who has volatile results. Go ahead.
Yeah, someone who's got a volatile game, someone who's got a really high ceiling but just doesn't pick up results because mentally they're a bit weak and just very, very inconsistent player. So I would look at someone like Djokovic again, round three, maybe against Davidovich Fokina. As if Djokovic isn't fit and playing at someone with a high ceiling, that could be quite fun. I don't think that he'll lose to Fokina, but it's an interesting one where you're just looking at down the draw a little bit of players who have shown that they can beat good players. I mean, Davidovich Fokina took 49% of points off Alcaraz in Barcelona, losing 7-6, 6-4. So he clearly does have the game on occasion to rival the best. You know, in previous years, we'd have said this about someone like Fognini. Certainly not now. Certainly not in five sets, but that type of player, you know, someone with a bit of flair, someone with a high ceiling over a short period of time.
Oh, we lost Dan there at the end. He's getting audio bouncing in and out. Okay,
basically saying the opposite of a Skamnori.
Yes. The opposite of a Skamnori. Someone who you know what you're getting with every single time out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Really, more even the opposite of a Roberto Bautista Agut. Like, that's the opposite of the type of player that Dan is describing.
Yeah. So someone who's not solid but is spectacular.
Exactly.
Well said. That's the great way of saying it. By the way, do you see any first round numbers? I do not anywhere. Do you see any match numbers yet? Bookmaker does not have them up. DraftKings does not, for instance. But even if we don't have access to numbers, which maybe you can,
we can pull some up.
Oh, you got some?
Yeah, we can pull some up. What any specific matches?
Yeah, I'm just saying. Does anything stick out to you first round where you're like, oh, that number seems off to me?
Let me pull up something. Usually the check markets have something up, if nothing else. Doesn't look like they are though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I see nothing. Dan, you see anything?
Apart from qualifiers, I see nothing.
Yeah, just qualities.
No, nothing.
Just qualities right now. So we're doing.
That's weird.
We tried to do this as late as we could and after the draw, but we're still too early for first round numbers, which usually I thought we had them up. This is a little strange that we don't see them, but we don't. Let's go to the women's side. I guess we've covered. So if we're saying, let's just wrap up the men's side. If we're saying it's just so top heavy, right? For decades, you know, as long as you guys have been doing and I've been doing tennis podcasts and that we've been doing it with each other, the men's side has always been, you know, Roger and Rafa and Djokovic, and now in some ways Djokovic and Alcaraz, and Medvedev in there as well. It is top heavy still. So you don't want to like be reckless and talk about random players because they're by and large not going to win this. But if I said, what's the single, but if you're forced to make one futures bet right now at this moment, that bet would be, Dan?
I would bet on Alcaraz, and I would, I know it's unoriginal, I bet on the favorite, but I think this is the last time we get him at like 2-1 before the French Open.
I'm with you. Drewski?
Current prices, I'll take Djokovic.
Djokovic. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. It's not sexy, but it's weird. That's what it is. All right. Women's side might be a little sexier. Now, I was driving to do a numbers game this morning at VSiN. Drew was kind enough to text me as the draw was coming out. And so the headline, when this is from you, Drew, from this morning, and you'll elaborate on this, but essentially the draw didn't do Iga any favors. And one of the things that obviously the biggest headline is, and again, the format being number one seed is on one side of the bracket, number two seed, both on men's and women's, entrenched on each side. After that, it's the draw kind of thing. And so the number three seed can end up on either side. And Elena Rybakina ended up on Iga's side of things. And you pointed out, Drew, that if it was a worst case scenario for Iga, worst case scenario down the stretch, talking round of 16, quarter, semis, final, would be Barbora Krejcikova, Coco Gauff, Elena Rybakina, Aryna Sabalenka. So if she's to, if that ends up happening, it would be a gauntlet. But the Rybakina thing is the biggest headline, I guess, would you say?
Yeah, and actually, I was giving you based on seed, but my power number for Kudermetova is a lot better than Coco Gauff right now. Yeah, so that actually makes it even worse. That's an even tougher road, I think. Because I thought, like, well, that's a tough stretch, but at least your quarterfinal is easy. But Kudermetova, yeah, she got the better of her 6-1, 6-1 in Madrid, but Kudermetova has been playing really, really well.
Kudermetova is one of those where I'm doing match
by
a
clear top eight player for me right now.
Yeah, when you do like match by match with Kudermetova, I was on clay. I'm always startled by usually the numbers that come up. Though now, actually, that I'm going through them, they're not all that startling, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird because like her hold breaks are not spectacular. She's just a little better than average. In fact, her hold break number is underperforming her sets one return one number. But her quality of opponent has gone up substantially this year on clay relative to last year. Median opponent was 61 last year in 11 matches. This year it's 25, and she's held her own against a tougher field. But maybe even more than that, she's playing a lot of clay. Like, she's getting the reps and just in general is becoming a pretty interesting player. Now, I don't think realistically she beats, Iga, but again, it's another match where Iga's going to have to expend fire some of her bullets in order to, move on. And, I'm not at the point in my life where I'm like dying to bet against Iga on clay in any tournament ever. And I've definitely run numbers in big matches before, notably the Madrid final, and said, holy smokes, there is an enormous value on the dog here. And the market can only get more and more and more Iga. That number drifted from +250 to almost 3-1 on Sabalenka at Madrid. And even though the conditions favored her, I couldn't pull the trigger because it's very, very tough to bet against someone who is as outstanding as Iga is on clay.
Maybe you were about to say this, and I guess that's the big question, right? So Iga down after the draw to about -120, -125. She was like -145 at one point. That's the big question. Like, Iga pulled out most recent tournament, thigh injury against Rybakina. It was 2-2 in the third set. This was in Italy where Iga was going for a three-peat. And I guess that's the big question. Do you believe that if Rafa is the king of clay, that Iga is such the queen of clay that none of all of this other stuff is noise and her form will magically appear again? Or is there enough evidence now to suggest that while she never loses matches to, you know, huge underdogs, that there is a group of two or three, right? And we're talking about Rybakina and Sabalenka, and let's throw Barbora Krejcikova in there because that also happened. That at least those three players, that maybe there's a little bit, it's the old, you can't quantify in your head kind of thing. Like, where do you stand in that whole sort of dynamic with her? Because I think that's the biggest question here.
Yeah.
Right?
She's got a couple of advantages that I am willing to suspend disbelief in that she's not going to be physically there. She's had a full week of recovery. The tournament in the women's side, for as difficult as the men's draw is, or a men's slam is physically because of the best of five nature, the women's is a little bit more relaxed than your average tournament physically because it's still best of three and they get a day off between matches. And she's going to get the absolute, cherry order of play, arena and all of that. So it's, she's, She's and oh, by the way, like week one, Christina, as hard as
Christina Buxa, her first round opponent. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't give Buxa much of a chance here, but yeah, week one for Iga looks to me like a warm up. And so there's not really a whole lot of threat that she won't be there come round four, but then the going gets very tough. And, you know, Iga's funny because what she did on clay last year was so superlative. Her hold break numbers were three standard deviations above average for women's performance on clay. That is a Z score of three.
Yeah.
That is in the world of probability, that is usually where you're cutting off your epsilons. Don't worry about anything higher than three or worse than minus three. It's just, it's so rare. Don't even worry about it. That's where she was. So she was on like the cusp of, you know, the impossible last year. And this year she's down to a pedestrian 2.6 standard deviations over average.
Yeah.
So it's not really that, you know, it's not really that shocking. And oh, by the way, this year she's played tougher opponents. Yeah. Her median opponent last year ranked 43rd. Her median opponent this year on clay is ranked 21st.
Yeah. Parlance, Dan, like last year, talking about service and return points combined, it was like 122 or something. Now it's like 116, right? So it's exactly what you're saying.
Crazy. She was one. What was it? She was 150. I'm sorry. She was 115 last year, and this year she's 10. Oh, sorry, I have my number sorted. She was 117 last year. This year she's 115 service plus return.
And I think it's important for the listeners to throw a little bit more context on those numbers as well, because I perceive anything over 110 plus to be absolute elite, and it's also worth noting that the no other player in on tour really get close as well. So not only is there a huge deviation between her and the mean, there's also a significant gap between her and her main rivals as well.
I completely agree with that, although I have to say that compared to last year, the gap is narrower because the second best player in the world, we could have, and we probably did argue this for US Open. I know we did for Australia. We may have of who is the second best. It wasn't obvious for a long time. And now it pretty clearly is Aryna Sabalenka. She's locked into the two seed. Her, you know, again, kind of hold break standard deviation numbers that I happen to have in front of me. Her, you know, we said Iga went from 3 to 2.6. Well, Aryna is up from on clay, by the way. You know, she's up from basically an average player on tour to now 1.5 standard deviations better than average. So that's a humongous improvement.
Yeah.
That's a huge, huge improvement. Sometimes those improvements are, you know, regression is coming. But from eye test, she has looked the real deal from what I've seen, the way she's played this year. And I definitely give her a pass for her loss in Rome because, you know, she clearly set her eyes on this tournament as opposed to trying to back up her Madrid title with another kind of deep run. That, by the way, Madrid title deep run completely cooked Ons Jabeur last year at Roland Garros. And I think Aryna was wise to only choose one of those two to really put her chips on the table. Yeah, so I think the gap is narrow between 2 and 1, and Iga's come a little hair back down to earth. And in the back of your mind, the injury question mark lives. I guess as the physical part of things being relaxed, it is still noteworthy that the mental part of the women's draw seems to be still a really, really huge factor. And I mean, last year, 3 years ago, like, she was unbeatable and people didn't think they stepped on the court and had a chance. And now maybe they do.
Maybe they do.
Certainly, the third choice, Elena Rybakina.
Well, and that's interesting, right?
Because Robotkina believes she can win every time.
Yeah, she believes it, right? But like, that's a great point, because if you do it by the numbers we were just talking about, she doesn't come up as elite necessarily, right, Dan?
Not at all. It's wild.
I think that's the key. And if we're looking value in this women's market right now. I think you almost just ignore Iga because you don't want necessarily want to back against back a player who's odds on and has a thigh injury. Although they say it's not anything serious, it's not certainly not positive, and the market movement has not really moved today following the draw either. So certainly I wouldn't want to back the price, but I wouldn't want to back against someone who's so in play either. So I think we just ignore Iga. And I think the main conversation that we need to have is between Sabalenka and Rybakina.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
And Rybakina had literally very, very, very little track record on clay until Rome. And, you know, if we look at through her career on clay, we have to go back to 2020 to find the last clay event that she reached the final in. And that was like a 250 in Strasbourg against nobody. And then we have to go back to 2019 to find a clay title, which was like a field of challenger players in Bucharest. So this is a surface that she hasn't enjoyed. This is a surface that, if we're looking at a men's player, this is like Medvedev 2 years ago, kind of similarity, if that makes sense. And I can't have this price on Rybakina at all.
I'm with you. That's why I say that. Yeah,
it's a crazy price.
And you know what? If Sabalenka had won Rome and Rybakina had lost to Sofia Kenin in the first round, Rybakina will be about 30-1 right now.
Ooh.
Yeah.
She's traded at 36 on Betfair. And even not so long ago, 27.
Yeah, my numbers for her on clay, considering her lifetime of performance, and I'm a time decay guy. I love the recent performance much more than I care about what she did 2 years ago. I have her as the 20th best player in this field. But at the same time, slam tennis is a mental game, and she has the most, she has the strongest mental demeanor of any women's tennis player I've ever seen. She's unflapped by anything. She's having a terrible match. She's having a terrible set, terrible point. She still finds, you know, wild ways to pull out winners. And that I think is worth something at the slam level. And you may just have to kind of be willing to throw some, you know, shift her distribution in some way, because, you know, the Brooks Koepka kind of effect.
I think I agree with that.
He's going to give you his best golf in a major. In the rest of the tournaments, you're going to get what you get. And there may be a little bit of that in Rybakina.
Yeah, maybe. I think I agree with that guy. She is unflappable. Even Iga, when things are going on, like you could see it in her face, right? There's a little bit of flush to it. If it weren't for these pesky numbers, Drew Dinsick, you know, that I just can't get past, you know?
So, well, the real dream is if Mira Andreeva gets drawn into that qualifier slot and we get a Rybakina Andreeva round one. Woo-wee, that would be fun.
That would be nice. Who is, besides Andreeva, who, if we've been tracking female, if we've been tracking ladies tennis here over the course of the last few months, there have been a handful of young players where you're like, oh, this could be something. She's definitely one of them. Who might you be looking at here in the French Open?
I don't think you can look past her as far as the kind of young outsiders. The Czechs have kind of disappointed this year.
Your Noskovas.
Noskova's been good.
Your Fruvertovas of the world.
Yeah. Fruvertovas both have been a little bit underwhelming. Yeah. Bajelic has been decent. But I don't know. Realistically, the two Russian sisters, and particularly Mira, has, at least based on what we've seen, even today in her qualifying straight sets win, was she was pretty spectacular every time she needed to be. So, she's going to be fascinating to see where she lands in this draw. But I think the Rybakina has a funny kind of broad distribution, I think, of outcomes here, where a Noskova, who probably goes against her round two, could beat her. Absolutely, based on my numbers, that would not be a shocking result at all. But at the same time, the longer Rybakina hangs around in this draw, the more likely she is going to be able to pull off the upset against an Iga, a Sabalenka, certainly an Ons Jabeur in a quarterfinal setting. I guess we didn't really talk about Ons Jabeur at all last week, Dan. I'm just curious your opinions. I was pretty surprised when I just crunched the numbers after getting the draw at the likelihood I have of Jabeur making a run here. And I know you have to put a little bit of a flag on it, because last two times we've seen her on court, she got beaten convincingly by Badosa, and she would she retire against Iga? I can't remember, but there's some flags in terms of health and fitness, surely, but just the raw data you get from Charleston tells you that she took a step forward on clay this year.
Her numbers are great.
Yeah, and honestly, she's the best player in Q2.
If she's fit.
Guys. Say again what you just said.
I think she'd be fourth favorite if she was fit.
Yeah, if she was fit. By the way, Paula Badosa, who you just mentioned, not in this draw. She pulled out this morning. Okay, so I'll ask the same question. This is a ridiculous question to ask on the ladies' side. But if I came to you from the future and I said, oh, Iga, she didn't get it done. Nor did Sabalenka. I don't know, maybe the serve yips came back, whatever. And it wasn't Rybakina, like the numbers, manifested for her. Who did win this?
I'll let Dan go first here. Let's see.
Sabalenka.
No, she's off the board.
Just to go a little bit.
She's off. You can't pick her.
Oh, sorry. I missed that. Sorry. I didn't miss the last bit of the question.
No Iga, no Sabalenka, no Rybakina.
I look at Q3, and I think someone's going to have to come through that bracket. Could it be a Sicari or someone like that, or Pegula, I don't know. That would be kind of my thoughts, because there's a lot of players who are going to beat each other in this, and you literally, maybe not sticking a pin through 123 players, but you're sticking a pin through 20 or 30. And I think when I caught up with Drew last week, we mentioned, both of us agreed that there's question marks over every single other player. I mean, on the Pinnacle pod, Drew was more brutal than me, and he was like, line through, line through, line through, line through, line through.
Be brutal, Drew.
If you're going for numbers and peak, you probably would say, Jabeur would be, like I say, the fourth favorite if she was fit.
Yeah.
But then I'm not inspired by anybody, to be honest with you, Gil. And further to what Drew was talking about, with regards to Andreeva and those young players who are kind of, could they find themselves in, say, like, attached to someone who's highly ranked player, high in the outrights, or someone who might find themselves randomly in the fourth round as a young qualifier or something like that. I've been waiting for this for a long time, and let's. I haven't checked the results today, but is Clara Towson still in qualies as well?
Boy, I haven't heard. We haven't talked about Clara Towson in a long time.
I'm pretty sure her final qualifying is tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, we would have said 2 years. 2 years ago. 2 years ago, we would have been talking about her in that kind of bracket, right?
Yeah. We would have been, and we did.
She's up against Bjorklund in the final qualifying tomorrow. Yeah. I think it's
such big hopes for.
All right. So you still got got it for Clara Towson as possible to watch, see if she gets through the qualies here. Drew, who would be that player for you?
So my distribution of potential wins here is absolutely crazy. I have Iga winning just over 35% of the time. So not bettable at this number. I have Sabalenka winning just over 20% of the time. So bettable at this number. And then the next tier, I don't have anyone else with more than a 5% chance here, which means I'm not taking anything better than 20-1 on any of these players. But the next tier of, a little under 5%, I have Kudermetova, I have Rybakina, I have Jabeur, and I have Ostapenko. And Ostapenko was one where you could have gotten a bigger price. I guess I'll give her a little shine. She's obviously a slam champion, so you have to upgrade her a little bit just on pedigree.
Won this tournament in 2017.
Yep. That was a little bit of a lightning in the bottle, kind of 100-1. I think she went off in that title run. Beat Simona Halep, who couldn't get across the finish line in the final there.
Simona Halep also not in this tournament.
Yeah. Also not in this tournament. Yep. The Ostapenko numbers this year compared to what she did last year on clay are like, looks like a different player. She was standard deviation below average last year in all of the key metrics on clay. And this year she's a standard deviation above. Quality of opposition has been good. We've seen 9 matches of her on clay so far this cycle. And, I think overall, if she can kind of have a cool head, just her general kind of approach to tennis, her aggressiveness is, it's favorable against this, this type of a field. So Ostapenko, I think if you can get better than 20-1 is a fair play. I make her right around 5% to win. And then the next tier of players is just 1s and 2%, like the
Krejcikovas of the world. Yeah.
And if Krejcikova was on the bottom instead of in Q1, I think my number would look very different. But in, having to go through Iga and then getting Iga's draw after that, in round 4 is just, that's death. The same kind of mindset as Tsitsipas. Like, we could sit here and argue Tsitsipas is like the third or fourth best men's clay player in the world, but he's going to have to go through, he's going to have to go through all of the bogeymen to get to a final here. So forget about it. And Krejcikova is kind of in that same boat. I'll believe it when I see it with Sakkari. I'll believe it when I see it with Pliskova, with Pegula.
Go ahead. No, finish your thought. Because I was just looking. I had Ostapenko against Rybakina in the semifinals in the Italian Open. She just sort of, once she lost the first set, she got rolled actually in the first set, but she had no competitive fire in that match at all. And I remember just thinking, it's not what my numbers tell me, but you're corroborating what I'm saying for those two, that we juxtapose those two players. Yeah.
The only long shot that I bet, is Elisabetta Cocchiaretto.
Elisabetta Cocchiaretto. I love her. I've won a lot on her. Yeah.
I give her a 0.6% chance to win this tournament.
Yeah.
So anything better than, anything in the 200-1 or better range, I'm in. I think I found some 500-1 on her. So that would be fun if she can make a little bit of a run. She didn't get that bad of a draw. She's going to have to go through Jabeur and then Rybakina if Rybakina's even there. But I could see her winning Q2, which would be a ton of fun. But the nature of the distribution and why this is so weird is usually that you can kind of cross off everyone past like, player 8 or 10 or whatever. And this one, the win shares are just sprinkled all through the middle and bottom. Like there's nobody of quality who ought to be priced between 10 and 100. And then the real deal long shots, you're going to see somebody insane make it to the quarterfinals, finals, or semifinals here. I just don't think at that point they realistically have a chance to beat the likes of the Sabalenkas and the Egos of the world.
Since we bring it up with Rybakina's numbers, Dan, is Coco, if I asked you, who's the player that has overperformed the longest that you just absolutely don't buy into? Is it still Coco Gauff for you?
Well, do you know what, Gil? It's so funny you mentioned this. That's why I was laughing, because this was going to be my next question to Drew. Was going to be, what do your numbers say on the win percentage
Wait, so say again. What do your numbers say on what? Start again, Dan. What do your numbers say?
His win percentage estimate for Coco Gauff. Because
we're so far
down the board. It's
we've talked about her consistently as being overrated. I've been really strong on this when we've chatted so many times, and yet consistently she's been around that sort of 15-1 mark in a Grand Slam in the outrights, and I've just been horrified by the price. Literally, you could treble it, and finally we've gone to a tournament where that is trebled. So look, she's a player, I think, who's Drew mentioned that sort of Brooks Koepka analogy, someone who's much better in the bigger tournaments. I've done some research on that previously, and her numbers in Masters and Slams are better than kind of the routine tour events. I mean, but she's taken a real backward step, I think, this year.
Remember, she lost to Iga in the finals of the French Open last year.
Was that really just last year?
That was the finals. God. 6-1, 6-3. Yeah.
That feels like so long ago. She's taken a huge step backwards this year. So again, like I'm a time decay kind of person. So I look specifically at I have a specific heat index parameter where I'm looking at last year. How'd you do this year? How'd you do? Key metrics. Who'd you play? How many matches did you play? All that sort of stuff. And, my heat index for her is basically like, you have to meaningfully downgrade this player. She's been a standard deviation below average on tour, in hold break, half standard deviation below on serve and return points won. This is below an average player, not even below like a top 20, top 10 kind of a level. So, she's playing tennis, pretty uninspiring tennis right now. And honestly, I can't answer Dan's question because to kind of keep my table nice and tidy, I cut it off before she made it onto the list. So I got to rerun with a bigger, let me make it a little bit bigger and see what I got for her.
Yeah, a few decimal points to get somewhere.
I have her down with Mayar Sharif.
Oh my.
Ludmila Samsonova, Marta Kostyuk, who obviously Kostyuk is a good player, but it's got to go through Sabalenka. She's got to go through Sabalenka in round one. I have her down with Sorenko, Pavlyuchenkova, Petra Martic. These are kind of the prices. I give her about a 0.2% chance to win this slam.
Got her down with Petra Martic. Dano, we shared a brain on that one. We were all about, we shared the Coco Gauff frequency right there. So, by the way, there's these bets offered. And, you know, I don't usually make these bets, but since we've just talked about a men's and a women's side of a slam where obviously the top heaviness exists, and Drew just spelt it out with his numbers, there are bets offered there for Iga Alcaraz, basically a parlay, double wins, right? Iga Djokovic. Iga Djokovic is 4-1. Iga Alcaraz is like +260, +270. Would you ever make a bet like that, guys?
I mean, if you had huge, if you had, you know, if you basically the only reason I'm betting outrights is because at this stage with the draw out, if there's not like, if you're not like shooting for a long shot, if you're trying to capture value or capture quarter, blah, 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 like realistically, you're just trying to play the imbalance of the draw and hope that there's chaos on the other half. And so you could play a Medvedev Sabalenka and feel pretty darn good that if chaos ensues, you're just all of the, something happens to Djokovic. Where's the, you know, there's going to be an enormous win share that dumps into the Alcaraz pool. There's going to be a bunch that goes to Medvedev. Something happens to Iga. Something happens to Rybakina. All of that money gets dumped into the Sabalenka pool. Alcaraz gets surprised early. That then all of a sudden Medvedev, you wake up one morning and he's your tournament favorite, right? Like there's realistically the imbalance in the draw, I think sets up well for, you hope chaos happens on the other side and your player dances their way to the final, and then all of a sudden they're playing a much easier opponent than the market thought today. And those two players in this particular setting are Sabalenka, because she's on the bottom with the other two, you know, kind of big three on the top, at least by the market. And similarly, Medvedev with Alcaraz and Djokovic on top.
Boys, is there anything we left out here? I know, I mean, it occurs to me, again, there's going to be people here who, you know, a lot of our listeners are going to want something sexy. Hey, sometimes it's not, this is just how it plays out. And the French, and this particular surface, especially on the women's side, and then traditionally with Rafa on the men's side, has always been so dominated by one human being. But certainly now it's, you know, it's always been a contender here and there. And we have two definite favorites, if not three, on the men's side. We have one, if not two or three, on the ladies' side. And that's just how it is. And so match to match will be the way to go on many of this. And if you're just, you know, we could throw out sexy futures plays, but sometimes that would just be a stupid thing to recommend. And so based on the numbers, those are scarce. Is that a fair statement, would you say?
I think so. The chances that we had, you know, a couple of years.
Sorry about the technical problems with Dan's
on Twitter.
Go ahead, Dan.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. The eager heavy, you know, long shot prices a few years back, which were obviously notorious. They don't grow on trees. You know?
they really don't.
No, that's like a one to the 10 or 20 year kind of scenario. And for me, I'm going to kind of look at this women's event as if she's not in it. So basically, who's my pick from the bottom half of the draw? Who's my pick from the quarter, which doesn't have Swiatek, Rybakina, Sabalenka? Those kind of things would be if I was going to give someone advice for looking at some prices, longer prices in the women's tournament, it would be to hunt around in that bottom half of the draw a little bit. So that would be something. And obviously the match to match stuff, which is kind of what I do a lot more anyway than outright. So and also be cognizant, if you're listening to this and you're looking for some advice, be cognizant of the fact that there's quite a bit of juice in outright markets.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So not only do you have to be right, you've got to be right to a large extent as well.
Not getting the proper bang for your buck, the whole percentage is huge for the books. By the way, Dan, would you is there a name or two then in the bottom, you know, in the portions of the quarters that don't involve ego or that you might recommend?
Yeah, so I'm gonna really delve into some more stuff in that sort of the anomaly quarter, if that makes sense. But I'm gonna crunch some numbers between now and the weekend, and I'll publish everything on my Betfair column, which you can find at betfair.com. So that'll be on live on Saturday.
Very good, betfair.com for Dano. And he'll link to that from his Twitter at Tennis Ratings. Drew, anything for you? Last question on that. Is there a quarter play?
I don't think that I'm not dying to get down on anything right now. On outrights, but quarters, I am desperately waiting for prices here. And there are a couple that I will fire on as soon as we see them. And the most obvious to me, as far as a quarter price goes, is going to be Veronika Kudermetova in Q1. And yes, I know that's Iga's quarter, and we started talking about that. Hey man, the way Iga's being priced right now, the tax on backing Iga right now is that's the VIG. That's the hold. it's all there.
Obviously being facetious. Yes.
Yeah, it's all there. And so you can do a little bit more clever getting into a quarter instead of the full outright pool in terms of, you know, kind of getting a VIG free type of price. And Kudermetova is going to be the fourth choice by the market in that quarter, because outrights are telling you that Krejcikova and Goff have better odds for her to win, you know, to win it all than, you know, so she's right away the fourth choice in a quarter with Iga. You're going to get her at just a beautiful number there. So that's going to be a fun one to put in pocket. I see enough quality there that I don't mind going to war with Cooter. I have some 500-1 on Coach Chiaretto, but I'm going to like her Q2 price even better. I think that quarter is ultimately pretty weak, even though Rybakina is in there because of the reasons we talked about. Q3 is the kind of the journey woman's quarter. And what I'll be very anxiously waiting for is what I'm hoping for is that Q3 quarter prices go up and that there's some shuffling and that we get a little bit of a stability, and then they draw the qualifiers, and Mira ends up as one of the four qualifiers in there, because that's like a path to, oh my gosh, first slam, like Raducanu type of stuff, where she comes through qualifying and marches her way all the way, not to a title, but at least to a semifinal. Wouldn't shock me at all, because I couldn't, other than Muhova, I don't see anyone in that quarter that really has put together enough quality to warrant a back. And then, yeah, Sabalenka, I think, comes through on Q4, but I don't think you're going to get much of a price there. So that's a pass. So, yeah, Kudermetova, Coach Yaretto, and fingers crossed that Mira ends up in Q3.
I co-sign on Coach Yaretto. And I would love to see where Andreeva ends up as well. I would co-sign on those two. And you're right, and you bring up Raducanu. Raducanu not in this draw. Also point that out as well. All right, boys. I think we've done all we can do. This is going to be fun. This begins now stateside. This begins Sunday night, I believe, Drew, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct.
And you, of course, Dan, will have this on Monday.
Sunday morning for us.
It's the French Open. Australian is Sunday night. This will be Sunday morning.
Super duper late Saturday night.
So if it's 10 a.m. UK time on Sunday morning, so that will be 2 a.m. Vegas time, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, we're basically Saturday night, Sunday morning. Time zones. They're pesky. all right. Dan Weston from at Tennis Ratings, all his stuff at Betfair, he'll have some quarter thoughts as well for both the men's and the ladies' side. And Drew, you spelled it out very nicely, what you're looking for on the quarters. Let's go, Iga. Let's go, Carlos. That's all I got to say. In the end. You know where I stand. It's very chalky. Drew from whale_capper on Twitter. And of course, NBC Sports Bet the Edge podcast and The Deep Dive with Andy Molitor, which he does each. How many deep dives a week you do, Drew?
Off season, we're just doing one. Kick back up preseason football. We're going to do three. Ooh. Two specific division, two team previews, and then an interview. So we're going to ramp up after July 4th.
Beautiful. All right, boys. Appreciate it. Drew Dinsick, Dan Weston, Gil Alexander. Thanks so much for listening. Good luck with all your bets. The French Open right here at the Beating the Book podcast. Thank you for listening.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts. If you dare.